from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. Author Rachel Kushner likes well-executed machinery, fast motorcycles, and a well-turned phrase. At least that's the impression one gets from her most recent book, The Flamethrowers. In writing that's smart, precise, and pithy, Kushner's narrator transports readers into mid-70s New York art scene and then into a chaotic Italy fraught with social unrest. The book has gotten people talking, both about the content and the style of writing, with some gender politics cropping up along the way. Many reviewers called The Flamethrower the most interesting book of 2013. What Kirkus Reviews may sum it up best, a novel of art and politics, but also bikes and speed. Stay with us for a conversation with Rachel Kushner on Forum next. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and today for Michael Krasny. Two-time National Book Award finalist Rachel Kushner's most recent novel, The Flamethrowers, takes readers into the world of a nameless narrator as she speeds forward in her young life. It's the mid-70s. She's in her 20s. She likes to ride motorcycles very fast and sets out to use her motorcycle, or a motorcycle, as the vehicle for making art. Photos of the tracks bikes leave in the soft ground. Our protagonist ends up leading readers into the exploding and daring New York art scene of the era, and then further afield when, alongside her lover, she heads to volatile Italy, a nation in the thick of social upheaval, violence, and leftist Red Brigade mayhem. As the story unfolds, we see this sweeping and complicated world from the perspective of a narrator who is at once bold, vulnerable, naive, and capable. The book is a tour de force, crafted with precision and a driving pace. It's no surprise that Kushner is now, with just two novels to her name, she's been twice nominated a National Book Award finalist. Her debut novel, Telex from Cuba, also won the California Book Award, among other accolades. And Rachel Kushner joins us this hour. Welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, tell us a bit about the book's narrator.
Sure. And by the way, that was such a wonderfully precise summary of my book. If only I had you with me everywhere I went. So the narrator, as you point out, does not have a name, although she's come to have come to be called Reno, simply, I think, for practical purposes, because she needs to have a name when people go to describe the book. But also she is from Reno, Nevada, and gets sort of jokingly, slightly condescendingly called that a couple times over the course of the narrative. She, as you say, is in her early 20s and moves to New York City in the mid-1970s to become an artist and to join the art world there, which is really, you know, where a lot of interesting things were going on at that time and is something I wanted to write about. But I also wanted the narrator to be a person not really versed in the specific codes and level of sophistication of the art world and to arrive and try to decode it.
Because she's very much in transition in her life, in her world. She's clearly who she is, no apologies. But she, as you drop her into this scene or she enters into this scene, she's ready to be formed. And she ends up being, to some degree, formed by this community.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, to me, that is what it is to be young to some degree. So it's just the way that I imagine a young person would feel when they encounter a milieu that they're not really equipped yet to understand. The way you understand is by being open and listening and taking in the kind of codes and signs and symbols that other people are using. So, yeah.
You know, authors are often tagged with being connected somehow very personally, that their characters are somewhat autobiographical. And there's no escaping in this book that this character, Reno, she likes machinery. She likes speed. She likes motorcycles. She likes art. And she's ready to sort of take on the world. And some of those elements intersect with you. You are a person who, my understanding is, enjoys motorcycles, has gone pretty darn fast on a motorcycle, and has also found yourself immersed in the art world. So talk a little bit about this intersection between you and the character and how you drew from your own experience, but also resisted it being too autobiographical.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's a lot I could say about that. And maybe first and foremost, the whole idea that authors are meant to promote their work in a way that has what they call a platform is pretty odious to me. I mean, I keep thinking recently that there's going to be a book called American Junkie, and the biography will say, you know, Joe so-and-so spent 12 years, you know, doing heroin in a SRO in the Tenderloin. And like the whole idea of having a platform where the author has lived the experience of fiction is odious to me, because the art of the book is the way that you take your whole life and your sensibility and your set of intellectual interests and your personal interests, the things that have formed you, and you convert them into something else. And the something else is the art, and it doesn't need a direct line. I don't need the biography flap when I read a novel to know that the author lived the experience that takes place in the narrative of the fiction. That said, I do believe at this, you know, point, I've only written two books, but it's enough to have some idea of what my methodology is. I believe in writing about worlds that I understand to some degree, and that there's been a kind of organic buildup of knowledge about them. As a reader, I like to read a narrative where I feel like I'm in the hands of an expert. When they write about something, I don't want it to just be some researched thing that they studied in order to give the narrator or one of the characters in the book a profession, for instance. I want them to write about things where they really seem like, you know, the subject supposed to know, like a narrator who's in command of the material. So The Flamethrowers, for me, was a pretty fun proposition at times, because it allowed for me to explore and write about areas that I happen to know something about. And in the case of motorcycles, I spent many years riding them actually in this city, San Francisco. But I've sort of put that behind me at this point in my life. But I do know a lot about bikes and something about cars and racing, and it's just always been an interest of mine.
Well, and I think there's no getting around the fact that the kind of the veracity, the passion, there's something the intangible that a reader knows when the author knows of what she speaks, you know. So your feeling of intensity about the speed, about moving so fast, as the character does, or the interest in the beauty and the machinery of an Italian bike, or you know, the idea that you can capture the art world, which has stumped a lot of writers who try to write about the art world, and it ends up being sort of caricatures,
yeah,
rather than a more subtle but kind of authentic take on the artwork. I think that really, you know, the author's experience within the world does come off the page.
Oh, well, that's good. Yeah.
What, talk a bit about writing about art, too, because I know you wrote within the art world. I think you wrote for Art Forum. Is that right?
Yeah.
So write about talk about writing about the art world.
Sure. Right. It's quite different than writing about art, per se, although the two are linked, but in more mysterious ways than I would have first conjectured when I set out to write this book, whose setting is the New York City art world, you know, downtown in the mid-1970s. That's a time and a set of artists and a discourse that is still so relevant to the art world that when you go to write about contemporary art, you have to know about the primary artists who were working in the 70s and the main kind of paradigm shifts that happened at that time, which might be best summarized as the dematerialization of the art object. It was no longer hip to make paintings and sculptures, discrete objects that could be sold. People were doing performances, very ephemeral things, you know, like a dance performance on a roof, something that can only really be captured in process photographs and
or,
so forth.
As in the book, a character that seemingly is a performance artist who really just lives in parks, and that is his art. Well, that's
yeah. Well, I actually based that on a real artist, a really brilliant artist from the late 1970s who tied himself to the feminist theorist Linda Montano, performance artist also. And they lived connected by, I think, 7 feet of rope for 1 year. So they never left each other's side. And apparently when the rope was cut after the year had been completed, they turned in opposite directions and walked off and said not a word to one another. So the intensity of that time, in any case, that time is something that you have to understand in order to write about art. And young artists still are very much referring to the work of like the Pictures Generation artists, maybe most famously Cindy Sherman, these people who understood media culture and advertising and kind of the logic of images, the cell, as it's put. And so, you know, I picked up certain knowledge about that world.
But you didn't accidentally pick up that knowledge. You, to some degree, as a young person, as a teenager, were sort of immersed in it because you had family in New York and in the art world.
Right. I've always been interested in the art world. Always, always. And as a kid, my dad's from New York City. My grandmother would take me to the museums. You know, I took a lot of art history in college. When I moved to New York, I started working at a magazine called Grand Street, and the art editor was a very famous curator named Walter Hopps, and I got to spend a lot of time with him, talking to him. He was the first person on the West Coast who gave Andy Warhol a show, like really a huge figure in the art world. But that said, when I went to write a novel that is meant to give a portrait of the art world, I didn't use, like, just in terms of filling out the narrative, a lot of what I know about art theory and artists. I decided that I don't think that it really works for fiction. And I didn't want a lot of, like, fictional artworks or people speaking art theory on the page. I just think it's dull and it starts to seem contrived.
Well, it wouldn't be what would be coming out of Reno's mouth.
No.
Or mind.
I don't think so. You're right. And also, you know, a big experience of the art world is the personalities and the way that people speak. And, you know, the unconscious drives a lot of what you do with fiction, but that became more elemental and important to me to replicate was the personalities, which is the side of the art world that you don't write about when you write an article for Artform, for instance.
Well, the other thing that I think lent it so much authenticity was the fact that, you know, young Reno wouldn't have known who among this crowd would go on to be, you know, groundbreaking. Who, you know, it was probably a feeling that was on the air that this was new territory that was being entered into. But nobody yet knows at that stage of the game where things are going. So the awe factor or, you know, getting into jargon or being all technical and theoretical wouldn't have been part of her picture. It would have just been that this is this cast of characters I'm coming across, not steeped in lots of language, but just these are the people of my world. They happen to be of the art scene.
Right. It's true. But I mean, one should also remember that I'm all the characters in the book, not just her. You know, people have asked me, is the narrator's experience kind of like your experience? And I think it's funny in a way that one would draw that conclusion because I created all the characters in the book. So the more knowing and wry and kind of sarcastic ones who are steeped in the art world, you know, I'm them as well.
Talking this hour with Rachel Kushner, her new book, The Flamethrowers, has met with quite a lot of critical acclaim. It's just been released in paperback. It was a National Book Award finalist. And I think you said, or I heard or something, that in a British award is in the making or something?
It was shortlisted for something called the Folio Prize, which is a new prize in England that's open internationally to Anglophone writers.
Well, congratulations on that. And if you'd like to join in the conversation and speak with Rachel Kushner, add some thoughts, comments, or offer a question, the number to call is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And, of course, Rachel Kushner has Bay Area roots as well. I think moving here when she was, I don't know, 10 years old, you were?
Yeah, exactly.
Has some history here in the Bay Area as well. And the earlier book, I should also mention, Telex from Cuba, was her debut novel, also met with great acclaim. And then The Flamethrowers has been the follow-up book. Now, both of these books that you've written are very immersed in a time and place. They're kind of they're locked into real times, real places, and real contexts. And I'm curious, it's so funny in reading this book, I thought this book had so many parallels with today. Yeah. And I, you know, I was in my own brain, I was thinking how, you know, this character Reno ends up over in Italy in the middle of sort of 70s upheaval there. And it, to me, so mirrored the Occupy movement.
Right.
And at the same time, although this may be like fingers on a blackboard to you, Rachel, I don't know, but the crazy art scene of New York seemed in my brain to be like the kind of free-for-all of technology right now. There's all this wide open territory and nobody knows where it's going to go. And people are being really adventurous intellectually and trying new things and scoping out new lands. So I thought there were lots of parallels with that 70s portrait you paint with today. But what I'm curious about for you as a writer is when you're locked into this time and place and location specificity, does that constrain you or is that freeing in some way because it builds a world that people know?
Well, that phrase locked in is not really something that I identify with. Maybe more so with the first book, Telex from Cuba, because I was interested in a sweeping historical phenomenon of decolonization. And in a way, that's really what that book was about, I mean, among other things that it was about. But with this novel, although it largely takes place in the 1970s, despite beginning with a scene that's happening in World War One, it's kind of about industrial history, and the 70s is the big decline of industrial life in the United States. You know, now I think there are very few people left who work in manufacturing in the U.S. But all that said, as I was writing the book, it didn't feel overly historical to me. The 1970s is a time that I remember because I was alive. It doesn't really seem like deep, deep history. And so much, as I said, in the art world, it's still quite relevant. Those artists who were ascendant then are still the major living artists, and they're all having retrospectives, and you can meet them and encounter them and speak to them. And in terms of the politics, I think a lot of people have felt that they relate to the book, even though it takes place in history. So it doesn't seem locked in, but maybe, you know, I just hear the positives. But I did a reading from the book before it was published in Los Angeles, and it was right during the kind of final showdown of Occupy when Oscar Grant Plaza was swept by the police and when, you know, L.A., they did it in the middle of the night. They just tried to just eradicate, and they turned on the sprinklers where all the tents were set up. And during that time, I gave a reading and I read a part of the book about this late 60s anarchist street gang in New York City. And apparently I cannot say their name on the radio. They're based on a real group, the Mother Somethingers.
Oh, yes. Mother Effers.
And when I did that reading, a bunch of people came who I know from people who are very involved in politics, like young anarchists and communists. And they thought that that part of the book was about them, which I thought was really great because they related to it. And when I was writing certain parts of the book, like there's a part about the blackout in New York City, and I thought a lot about looting and what it means, and I tried to describe looting. Well, you know, the looting in London was after Mark Duggan was killed by the police was going on when I was writing that part of the book. So a lot of people were theorizing about looting, and you could see photographs of it and think about what it means. Then when I had the narrator caught in a demonstration that becomes a melee in Rome and people are being tear gassed, I just looked up the live feeds of this guy, Oak Fachot, who did the he did a live feed from Occupy Oakland, and you could literally watch. I mean, you know.
So this was concurrent. You were writing while this was going on.
It just happened to be the case.
It just happened to be the case.
Yes.
You must have had in your mind, obviously, that this was already percolating and that the events of the world were mirroring, you know, something that you must have been thinking about for a couple of years. This didn't just spring out of nowhere. Or were you writing in response to some degree of, to what was going on?
It's less sort of deliberate and conscious than that. But to me, you know, writing a novel is it's a way of living in the world that I occupy. So it's as if I have a filter over my existence that is about turning experience into a book. And even though the book has a historical subject and certain themes that I care greatly about and want to do justice to, I still feel that I'm sensitive to my environment and what's going on around me. And in a way, a book that is partly historical is an intermeshing for me of what I know about life and what I'm trying to understand about history. And otherwise, it's a dead object. It needs to be open to the now. And I think in a way that I hope the book is.
Let's take this chance to have you do a bit of reading from the book, if you would. Why don't you set up what you're going to do? Again, this is from The Flamethrowers. It's Rachel Kushner. And tell us where we are and what we're seeing.
Okay. So I'm going to read a scene. It takes place early in the narrative. The narrator, nominally called Reno, has just arrived in New York City, and she knows absolutely no one there. She has the telephone number of one person, and she calls the number, and it's disconnected. And she has been spending her time wandering around, feeling at loose ends. And one evening in her wanderings, she encounters these two dissolute-seeming people in a bar who are friendly to her. And she's so lonely that she responds to their invitation to have a drink. "This is my wife," the nasal man in elegant clothes said as I sat down next to them at the bar. "Nadine." He said it again. "Nadine," and looked searchingly at her. She ignored him as if she were used to this audible pondering of her Nadine-ness in bars for the benefit of strangers. "We were at a wedding," Nadine said, turning to me. "They asked us to leave. They asked Thurman to leave, I mean. But I don't like weddings anyway. They make my face hurt." That was how she spoke. "Why did they want you to leave?" I asked. But I could sense why. Something about their presence in an empty bar many levels below what the man's clothes might suggest. "Because Thurman lay down in the grass," Nadine said. "He started taking pictures of the sky, just blue sky, instead of the bride and groom. He'd had a few, too." "I did not have a few, too. I was looking for something decent to photograph, something worth keeping, for posterity." "Oh, posterity," Nadine said. "Sure, great, if you can afford it. You could have just told Lester you didn't want to be the picture taker." There was a camera sitting in front of him on the bar, an expensive-looking Leica. "You're a photographer?" I asked him. "Nope." He smiled, revealing a tar stain between his teeth. "But the camera." I couldn't think of how to say it. "You have a camera, but you aren't a photographer." I sensed he would only keep meandering away, like something you're trying to catch that continually evades your grasp. "Better to say yes," Thurman said, "and then disappoint people. I mean, really let them down." "Lord knows you're good at that," Nadine said. "I'm talking about building a reputation." "So am I," she said. "All I want," Thurman said, "is for people to stop asking me to come to their weddings and funerals." "I don't mind funerals," Nadine said, "except when they buried my daddy in a purple casket. That was awful." She turned to me. "Thurman knew my daddy? Daddy was a mentor to him? A teacher?" "A mentor," I repeated, hoping this might lead somewhere to some explanation of who she and Thurman were, because they were someone or something. I was sure of it. "Well, my daddy was a, I guess you could say, pimp. Pimp is acceptable. I mean, now that he's dead. And you know what? People don't say procurer anymore. And my mother was a whore, so they got along perfect."
That's Rachel Kushner reading from her most recent book, The Flamethrowers. We'll talk more with her after a short break. I'm Penny Nelson, and this is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and we're talking this hour with Rachel Kushner. Her best-selling book, The Flamethrowers, is now out in paperback. Rachel's debut novel was in 2008, and it garnered great praise as well, and the California Book Award. It was called Telex from Cuba, and this most recent book, The Flamethrowers, is one that is set in the mid-1970s, and the protagonist is a character who is a young woman, heads to New York City, wanting to be an artist, wanting to be a landlord. landscape artist, and she ends up hooking up with this man who becomes her lover, an Italian artist, and that ends up taking her over to Italy, and a lot of drama, political and social drama that's happening on the streets there with leftist politics. So it's a very sweeping book, and the writing is remarkable and really a joy to read. So it's a pleasure to have you with us, Rachel Kushner.
Thank you.
We just heard her reading from the book. And I want to talk a little bit about another character in the book, the lover of Reno, Valero, Sandro Valero. Talk a little, the book opens with his family story, really, in World War One, and talk about why you did that. The book is very much of the 70s, but threaded throughout it is the narrative of this Italian motorcycle magnate family, really. And how is it that you decided to do that, thread this this family story through a very modern take?
Right. Well, it's not so much the family that interests me. I strangely, when it comes to fiction, I'm not really that interested in families. I don't know why. I have one. I love my family. But it's really about this guy, the father. And that the book opens with a scene in World War One when he is clobbering to death a German soldier with a headlamp from a motorcycle. And he's a kind of futurist. I don't name the futurists in the book, but I was thinking about Marinetti, who is from Alexandria, Egypt, as an Italian expatriate, but really a kind of person educated and steeped in French culture and interested, obviously, in poetry, but also speed and modernity and war and violence.
And machinery.
Modernity is meant to, capture that. And I've always been interested in the futurists. And their kind of fear of the new gets, at least in my own psychoanalytic interpretation of them, gets converted into a frisson of excitement about the new. I had been reading about Marinetti when his family moved to Milan. He was very alienated by all the streetcars and the noise and et cetera. And then the next thing you know, he's writing poems that are meant to be a kind of automata poetic version of explosions and internal combustion motors. And as someone interested in motorcycles and factory politics and industry, I thought, what if I had a futurist who then actually participates in industry and in machines and innovation? Because Italy, after World War II, up into the early 1970s, was producing some of the fastest, most modern motorcycles in the world. But the futurists did not participate in the industrial culture and aesthetics of Italy at all. They, made kind of brushy paintings about speed, but none of them really got involved in industrial design in Italy, which is a huge part of the culture of Northern Italy. So that was a prospect for the book that was important to me. So it's not so much about like family inheritance and the role of this family or their position as sort of aristocrats or anything. It's really about one guy and his vision. And he is the father of Sandro, who's the boyfriend of the narrator, who disconnects totally from his family and moves to New York City and just wants to be an artist. But I should say the artists working in the milieu in which Sandro works, minimalism, is really about industrial aesthetics. So in a way, he's commenting on something that he understands, but it's not really about industry. I mean, the minimalists had works that look like they are made on an assembly line, but in fact, they were handmade by a company called Lippincott in Connecticut, where every single thing is very fussily done. And then these metal boxes of milled aluminum have to be moved by people wearing cotton gloves and et cetera.
Rachel Kushner talking about some of the threads in her book. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to call is 866-733-6786, or you can email questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. And let's go to Leslie, who's calling us from Petaluma. Hi, Leslie.
Oh, hello. I wanted to thank the author for this book. I loved it. And what I found really compelling was your portrayal of her experience of her gender, meaning like her awareness of how she was being observed by everyone in her world, men, women, her physicality, and then at the same time her own internal dialogue with herself. It was great. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. That's really kind. Thanks for reading the book.
Great. Great. Okay.
You know, gender has been a real topic in a lot of the reviews as well around the book. And I mean, two things on this. And I want to talk about kind of the gender politics that have popped up in the reviews. But going back to what Leslie was saying, here's something I thought that stuck with me. Here's this young woman who is heading out on her own. And she wants to be an artist and she wants to go take on the world in her own way. And yet she does it. The way she can end up doing it is by attaching herself to this particular man. Now, she don't think goes out with the idea of doing that. But by virtue of being with Valera, he's the one that has the access to the motorcycle that she wants to use to make her land art. He's the one that has the access to the art world that she ends up being imbued in. He's the one that takes her to Italy. And I thought that was such an interesting, and I didn't even notice it till sort of much further along in the book, that she seems completely independent of needing a man, and yet it is a man that gives her entree.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's a lot of different things I could say about that, but maybe just to play devil's advocate, just for the fun of it. To me, that's more about youth and relationships. And sometimes when you're young, at least to me, having a relationship with someone is a way of annexing their world and making yours bigger. And it's not always so gendered. I mean, Richard Hell, the great musician from the Voidoids, came out with a memoir last year, I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp. And in it, he talks about moving to New York City when he was very young and knowing that he wanted to be involved in the world of art, in the world of the new. He wasn't really a musician, you know, in the beginning. He just wanted to, he was a poet and he wanted to be involved with culture. And he met Patty Oldenburg, who was the wife of Klaus Oldenburg. And she gave him, she was much older than he, and she gave him an education. And she took him to parties. And it wasn't just an education about the discourse of the art world. It was a social education. He got to be around famous artists and see how they talk and how they move and the way that they operate with one another. So there's a young man experiencing this same kind of experience, but with a much older woman.
And it is, as you say, the nature of being young and the nature of being open, which is what one of the things that's so appealing about Reno as a character. She is a bit naive and she's a bit, you know, she's wide-eyed in a way, but she's very competent and she's open. And when you're open and the opportunities arise, because I don't think the Valera connection, she didn't know about the motorcycle empire. She didn't know any of that when she and he became connected initially. So it wasn't a calculated move on her end. It's just entree.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's just one of the natural dynamics that occurs when a younger person dates someone who's a little older and a little more experienced. I mean, each person kind of comes with their currency, quote unquote, you know, not to monetize. But what she offered was youth, maybe not conventional, but some kind of beauty, you know, certain energy. And what he offered was experience and this entree. So there are trade-offs in relationships.
The book has been really well-received critically. But what I found interesting in a lot of the reviews is there's been a lot of commentary about you know, the muscular prose or the assertive writing or the confident character or the, you know, the confidence of the writing, as if and somehow that has tilted over into surprise. And as I found the writing just very interesting and very readable, enjoyable, all the stuff you want from a book. And then I went back and was reading reviews and was really surprised by the need to characterize you one way or the other and to say, right, if she's going to be one of the great American novelists, how can this be? She's a woman and the writing is so muscular. What do you think about all that?
Well, it sort of puts me in a funny position, like my hands are tied, because while you and I could probably have an interesting conversation about gender, I don't really feel that writers are allowed to respond to topics that come up in their reviews, because then it seems like you're trying to respond to your responders. And when a book is published and enters the world, I am quite sure that it is time for readers to have their say and that my say is encapsulated in the 416 or whatever pages of the book. And a lot of what I want to say about gender and my sensibility is all there. So once the book comes out, I don't really get to rebut what other people say about it. I mean, maybe I could just say that I don't see novels being gendered the way that perhaps their authors are. Writing fiction is a way to use the whole spectrum of your own sensibility and the sensibility of the person underneath the more performative aspects of gender, some of which you learn over the course of life. You get to be really your deep, real self when you're writing. And I think that some of what the real deep self is more neutral.
When you see these, I don't know how much you even read the reviews. One thing that struck me, though, is so many of these reviews that ended up turning towards gender as even a topic in the review were written by men. And I was looking for any review written by a woman, of which we know there are already much fewer than those that are written by men. But I was looking for any review that was written by a woman or article or anything that had to bring up the topic. And it didn't seem like women felt compelled to bring up the assertiveness or authority in your writing, whereas it just seemed to keep popping up. And these are reviewers I enjoy, reviewers I like. They're just fine. But I was surprised by the degree to which male reviewers were startled by the authority of your voice.
I'm going to take the fifth on that one.
All right, let's go to a couple of our emails. Robert is writing in saying, I really enjoyed the novel. I'm wondering if the author could talk about some of her literary influences in terms of other writers. Personally, Robert says, I liked Alillo and Cortazar, and what is Miss Kushner working on now? So let's first talk about some of your influences, and also if you would talk a little bit about Bay Area influences.
Bay Area influences, that's a big topic. Well, I'll start with the literary influences. I mean, it's always hard because it changes and one reads widely. And I never claim to be, you know, influenced by or protege of anybody I read. I wouldn't presume that their influence is detectable in my own work. But what I read for inspiration does include DeLillo, for sure. I mean, he was a huge author for me as a young discoverer. And I know his work well. I've read all of it. The book Amazons that he wrote under a pseudonym, I think, is maybe the funniest American novel of all time ever. It's just hilarious. And he cares about history in a way that I identify with. And he does justice to the movies and fiction in a way that I like. And he is alive to irony in the very turn of the phrase and even, you know, the employment of grammar. And I like that quite a bit. He never loses contact with the reader. But, you know, I read quite widely. I love Proust. He is one of my very favorite authors, and he's been on my mind because I taught a Proust seminar in the fall. And there's a writer named Curzio Malaparte who has he's dead, but New York Review Books Classics just republished his fantastic novel, The Skin. And it's something I was thinking about when I was writing Flamethrowers because he's Italian and it takes place in Naples when the Americans, quote unquote, liberate at the end of World War II. And it's an amazing book. Very funny, very devilish.
And you're very influenced by visual arts as well, right? Who are some of the filmmakers or artists that you're following or very eager to see new work from?
Well, I mean, that I would answer that differently if it was pertaining directly to Flamethrowers or other things. I mean, it's just always changing for me. There's like a bunch of films that I reference in Flamethrowers. But just recently, I think that Holy Motors by Leos Carax is one of the greatest. He really is the heir to the French avant-garde tradition, and that movie's genius. When I saw it, I've seen it four times in the theaters, and I would like to write a book as bold and as great as that film. I thought was great. It came out last year.
Tell me the name again.
Holy Motors. And in terms of Bay Area influences, I don't really know how to interpret that. I grew up in San Francisco. I moved here when I was 10. Lived in the Inner Sunset, which, you know, sort of, I guess, almost part of the Haight-Ashbury, the very inner part. Then I went to UC Berkeley. Then I moved back to San Francisco, lived on the corner of Haight and Ashbury. Then I lived in the Mission. I mean, I did San Francisco.
It's in the blood.
Yeah.
It's in the blood. It's in the blood. I should mention also that you will be tonight at City Lights at 7 o'clock in an event that's being sponsored by McSweeney's. So for folks who would like to pick up a book or go out and see Rachel Kushner, you can go to City Lights at 7 o'clock tonight. And that event... again, sponsored by McSweeney's. And another email comes in, or a question comes in from Bruce saying, do you ever imagine yourself trying to be a writer without the internet or the instant access to information that that provides? That's interesting.
Oh, it's a good question. I not only imagine myself to be that kind of writer, in certain respects, structurally, I am that kind of writer because I don't write on a computer that's connected to the internet. So when I'm writing, I don't have the outside world streaming in. I think, you know, lots of people do it, and I'm sure they make it work. But
do you shut yourself away? Because, I mean, I'm thinking about how the Occupy movement going on right at the same time you end up writing, coincidentally, I guess, about all of the stuff going on in the 70s in Italy. I would think there would be no way but for that to kind of be in the air you're breathing and inform what you're writing.
Of course. And as I said before, it's an elemental part of writing to me. But having a life and a social life and friends and conversations and reading stuff and like reading the internet in the evening when I'm done working is that doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean that I'm not also disconnected from it. When you go, for me, conjuring a fictional world requires deep thought and an ability to descend into a mental space that is a bit more trance-like, where finally your unconscious can speak to you and drive what you're doing. So I crave that space, and I try to get there, and I use a computer that's not connected to the internet. But, you know, I read a lot. I mean, you have to be open to the world to write the kind of books that I want and attempt to write. So there's a big engagement with the world. It's just not happening while I'm actually writing a scene.
Your parents were academics and sort of somebody, I think, said something about bohemian, or I'm sure they were very colorful characters, interesting people of the world. And you had, it sounds like, an interesting childhood where you were back and forth New York and then you're here. And I'm wondering, you're a mom now, right?
I am, yeah.
And I'm wondering if... you know, as a writer of pretty intense work and traveling and working in the world of literature and art, whether you draw on your parents as inspiration for how to be a parent when in this world of creativity and arts, or what you feel about being a parent and how much you want to take from what your experience was and how much of a role that played in your upbringing?
Right. Well, that's a big question. Yeah, my parents are scientists, I want to say. I guess that's academic in a way, but it's something very specific to grow up as the child of scientists. And they're actually here listening to this interview in the studio. I draw my inspiration for parenting 100% from my parents. They are wonderful people, and they're awesome parents, and they're awesome grandparents to my son. And I think a lot of people they react to the older generation when they go to raise their own child, like, I'm going to do things my way. But I was not like that, almost to a perverse degree. When my son was a baby, I would say to my mom, you know, he's crying, what do I do? And she's like, Rachel, he's your baby, you know, step up. They're very involved in my life. I mean, I have had a really busy year and busy life, and they play a big role in helping to raise my son. We're a close family, and I ask them for advice all the time. So I guess I'm lucky in that way. And they were and still are pretty unconventional people. They are part of the beatnik generation. So there's nothing to react against in terms of, you know, I want to have a more open and free life without my parents' values. I share their values, which is pretty cool.
In this book, you have photos where a lot of people put passages or quotes. And I'm wondering how you, A, came up with that idea, and B, the photos are beautiful but retro and interesting. Talk a little bit about choosing to do that.
I'm sorry, do you mean the photographs that are in the novel?
Yes, yes. So in the novel, at the beginning of certain chapters, not every chapter, there's a black and white photo, which and I, as a reader, was just sort of seeing that as a visual version of the quotes that often lead into a chapter. Like, this is going to set the stage for the chapter.
Oh, right. That's what you meant by quotes. I never thought about it that way.
Interesting, because I thought about it immediately that way. Like, oh, instead
right.
of getting a little telling quote,
yeah.
I'm getting this image.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, after I wrote the book, I ended up with a really large cache of images. And it's just part of the way I write. The same thing happened, actually, with my first book, Telex from Cuba. And with that one, what I did with the images was I made this website that has, like, these flash movies of still images with quotes from the book that are, like, subtitles. And then with this book, I also had a lot of images. And the editor of the Paris Review, Lauren Stein, called me and said, do you want to curate the art for an issue of the Paris Review? And it was the issue that was going to include a chapter of my forthcoming novel, Flamethrowers. And I said, yeah, what a cool assignment. So I utilized a bunch of the images that I'd collected for that. And then we were just about to go to press with the book. And I called my editor and said, could we just put images in the book as well? And she said, yes. And so I wanted to do it. It's not so often done. I mean, Sebald is kind of considered, you know, the one novelist who put images in his novels, but there should be more. It's just something that I wanted to do. But I don't consider the images illustrations of the narrative. I didn't want them to be overconnected.
Oh, that's so interesting, because as a reader, I was looking for lots of connection. I was looking at them as this is the tip-off to what the core feeling of this chapter is going to be. So I kept going back to the image, going, oh, how is this relating?
Right.
As if it was this intentional move on your part as you were writing.
Well, that's the thing about art is that you get to have that experience of it. I mean, it's there for that, but it's not overly schematic on
right.
my part.
Or it wasn't intentional incorporated into your writing. That's what's so interesting to me. A listener just wrote on Twitter, I think I have a new girl crush. I think that's you.
Oh, that's very sweet. Hey, cool.
So the book is called The Flamethrowers, and, you know, you automatically think of, there's an early reference to that, or I can't remember where it is in the book, the World War I kind of reference. But who else in this book are flamethrowers?
Yeah, it just sort of depends. I actually didn't come up with the title. I mean, I love the title, but that was my editor read the book, and then she texted me and said, I want to call this novel Flamethrowers. And I thought,
wow.
Good title. I'm not so great with titles. I have my
what was your working
I have my
title?
Talents.
This is a nameless narrative book. This is my nameless book
yeah.
with my nameless narrative.
I keep all the behind-the-scenes stuff behind the scenes.
Ah,
so let's just work with flamethrowers. I have this friend, a great writer, Wayne Kestenbaum. He just wrote a really wonderful book called My 80s, and he's a poet. And I told him the title, and he interpreted it to mean not these aggressive stormtroopers with twin tanks of fuel on their backs, but people strutting and strolling the streets of New York City and being kind of raconteurs, like throwing fire. And I loved that because it made it, it was like a flamboyance. So, you know, you can interpret it different ways.
Because I saw every character in their own storyline as their own flamethrower. They were each in their own. I mean, I guess that's a very obvious way to look at it. But they all had different roles in life and different places in the book. But in their own storyline, they were each throwing their. You know, they were each flamethrowers. So I kind of saw that. And then the image that's on the front of the book is also a very provocative one, and that's of a woman with tape over her mouth.
Yeah, the image that's on the cover was something that my husband Jason and I found on the internet. It's from an Italian underground magazine from the 1970s called I Volsci, which was the magazine of a autonomous collective in Rome on Via dei Volsci. And I don't think the girl is Italian because she's blonde and just doesn't really even look Italian, but they put her on the cover at a time when a feminist radio program had been invaded by fascists, and they actually shot up the radio show and injured like 8 women. And then the police shut the radio station down. And so the tape over her mouth is meant to represent censorship. And I really push to have it on the cover of the book. A lot of times authors don't have a lot of say on what their books end up looking like. And in this case, I just decided I'm going to go all out on this one.
It's a beautiful image.
Thanks. Well, finally they agreed, but at the last minute there was some resistance from the publisher because their lawyer could not guarantee that they wouldn't be sued for putting this – using this cover without permission. And I said, well, what is the danger? What kind of a lawsuit are you envisioning? Because the lawyer called me. This is the corporate lawyer for Simon & Schuster. And she said, well, let's say this woman who no one can locate has married a hedge fund manager and he doesn't know about her radical past. And I thought, great story. Let's take the risk.
Good call. Good call. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left. What are you working on now, if you can talk? I know you seem to like to keep the behind the scenes, but give us a hint.
It's a contemporary novel.
Oh, come on.
Well, I haven't written a contemporary novel yet, and turns out I think I have a lot to say about the state we're in and where we're going.
And we don't have very much time, but, you know, a lot of authors have what's called a sophomore slump. You know, they write a phenomenal first book, and your book, Telex from Cuba, was really well received. And then the second book, they don't have the same amount of time, the luxury of time and crafting that they often have had with their first book. So the second book can sometimes be a little bit of a letdown. And this book came really on the heels. Did you start writing this right after the Cuba book?
Yeah, I did. But I mean, that sophomore thing, I don't know. You don't hear about that much anymore. But my theory of that is that it maybe more pertains to people who kind of use everything they have about their own life to write a sort of, you know, Bildungsroman with their first book. And I didn't do that.
All right. So you held back and saved. There we go. That's why we've got the flamethrowers. Well, that's it for this hour. That's it for our time with Rachel Kushner. And thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, Penny, for having me on the show.
Rachel's the author of The Flamethrowers, and she'll be tonight at City Lights at 7 o'clock in an event that is sponsored by McSweeney's, and her earlier book is called Telex from Cuba. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And the interns, Jack Desch, Marisa Endicott, Mariam Jumiel, Hannah Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Danielle Radin. For KQED Radio, I'm Penny Nelson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.